So I'm here with Gordon Hogenson, a programming writer on the Visual Studio User Education team. How's it going, Gordon?
It's going well. Thanks.
So what are you going to show me today?
Well, I thought I'd show you something about discriminated unions. So you probably, if you've worked with other languages like C++ or C, you've probably dealt with unions. And you know that a union can be many different types. But you know, in C++ or C or other languages, you don't really use unions very often. So you might want to just forget everything you used to know about unions and look at discriminated unions as a sort of a nice new feature that F# supports, which you can use in conjunction with pattern matching, which we talked about last time, or you can use it to sort of simplify complex code. I'll show you how to do that.
Okay, great.
So what I want to look at first is a type that is defined in the F# library called the option type. So the option type is basically it's representing something that could have a value or could not have a value. So you can see this could be useful in a lot of situations where, like, maybe you're calling some function and it'll go off and try to generate, you know, a piece of information that may or may not exist. And so in that case, you could use an option type that would either return the value if it existed or if it could be created, or not return a value. And, you know, in F#, we don't like to use null to represent that. Like in a .NET program, you might return null, or a null pointer, or null reference.
So why don't you like to use that in F#?
Well, null is associated with a lot of problems. Like, you can get a lot of exceptions. Everyone's, I'm sure, gotten a null reference exception at some point. And that's kind of a way so if you use an option type, there's a different representation of the null value. So you're not passing nulls around and introducing exceptions, but you're creating a case that represents that there is no value.
Okay.
So it's a little bit more of an intelligent null.
Okay.
So let's take a look at some code. This what I've defined here is a little option type. Now this is the same definition as the standard option type, except that I've put it in here and named it my option, just so that you know you can see what it looks like. And so this my option is a discriminated union, and it shows me that you know, its full name is discriminated unions my option, and it's a generic type, and there's two possible values. This is a little bit reminiscent of like an enumerated type definition, where you have possible values on each line separated by this pipe symbol. So what we see here are a value called none and a value called sum. And as you recall from the C++ union, you know, you can have different types associated with a single union. And that's kind of the case here, except that in one case we don't actually have a value, and in the other case we have a value. And this value is this generic value. The quote mark and then an A is like a representation, well, it is a representation of a generic type parameter. So let's see if we can look at some examples to sort of clarify what we mean by this. So in the next couple of lines, I've created three different option values. Now the first one, my option one, I'm using the sum case. Here it says union case, my option dot sum. And it's taking a generic parameter. This is actually kind of like a constructor, some input argument. In this case, it's a float, 10.0, and then it's returning a mine option object, which in this case will be a float. So this one will just be the value 10.0. And you can see by hovering over my option 1 that type inference has deduced what the actual type of that type parameter is. In this case, it's float. And that's because 10.0 is automatically a floating point type because it has a decimal point in it. All right, so I can, you know, certainly use other types, like a string type. And so, again, I'm using this sum case here, which also creates an option. This time it's a my option string. The other possible thing is a none case, which I can doesn't take an argument. It just creates an option. But here it's an unknown type parameter. It's still in the type inference hasn't deduced a type parameter for that yet. So now I can use pattern matching to use this option type. So here's a function that really just prints a value. But because this is a case where we might have a value or we might not have a value, what this does is it has a pattern match expression, which is this match, and then the opt is the option value. And then the two possibilities are the sum and none. And what you notice here in the pattern match, we have a unknown value here, which is assigned to the value of the sum case. And then we have the none possibility. And so what it does is it basically just prints the value if there is a value, and if there isn't a value, it just prints no value. So let's try running this code in F-sharp Interactive. So I'll select the code, and I'll press Alt-Enter, and that all compiles. And let me just scroll up so I can see what was printed. You can see that in the cases where there was a value, it prints the value, and then in the third case, it prints no value. Okay, well, that's basically the option type, which illustrates some of the basic features of discriminated unions. The fact that you can have multiple cases, that some of the cases can have values, some of the cases can be sort of without a value. So let's look at a few more interesting examples. The next example I want to look at is a shape type. Now, I think most people have gone through some kind of object-oriented programming training, and you've probably looked at the shape as a base class, and then kind of a demonstration of inheritance where you look at different derived classes that represent different specific shapes like squares, circles, triangles, all inheriting from a common base class. So that's standard object-oriented programming. Well, needless to say, F-sharp, you know, is a functional language. Of course, it supports object-oriented programming as well. But what's interesting is looking at sort of using discriminated unions as kind of an alternative to a traditional object-oriented framework. Because if you think about it, sometimes object-oriented frameworks are a little heavy-handed. You know, there's a lot of overhead. There's a lot of different types. All those types have methods. There's a fair amount of code that goes into it. So by using a discriminated union to represent what you might have used a small object hierarchy to represent in the past, or in some other language, if you use... well, let's just look through the example, and we'll see how that's sort of less code than you might write if you were writing an object-oriented program.
Okay.
Okay, so the code here is the shape type. And it has... the union possibilities are actually the different specific shapes. So here's the circle. And there's a type associated with each case, which could actually be a single value. Like a circle, just if you just have one value like the radius, Danielle had defined the circle completely. So it only needs one value. You know, since it has two different axes, then it needs two doubles to be represented. So in F sharp, when you have two values that you want to put together, you use a tuple, and the way you represent the type of a tuple is by using the asterisk. So if I create, if I say ellipse of double star double, then what I've created is a tuple of two doubles. So that represents an ellipse. And then we could add equilateral triangles, since those all have the same side length. We just need one double for that. But then we might want to have a triangle where the sides can be of unequal length. And so we could put three doubles in for that. A square will just have one side length, so we can just put double there. A rectangle would have a height and width, and so we put two doubles in for that. So basically, this represents all these different shape types that we might need to work with. So I'm going to define my pi value, and I'm going to create a little function that we're going to use later, because we're going to write an area function, which is down here. And this is just a formula called Heron's formula, and it's a way of calculating the area of a triangle with three unequal sides. So if I look now at my area function, it's going to basically be very simple and take a shape, and it's going to use a pattern matching to match, depending on what type of shape it is, and then it's going to have the formula for the area of that particular shape. So again, you're always including this sort of argument or parameter here. So in this case, we're going to give it an actual name of what it represents, which is the radius, and that's that single double. If there are more than one value, then we use parentheses, and this is the tuple notation. So the ellipse will have the semi-major axes A and B, and the area of an ellipse is pi times A times B. For the equilateral triangle, we're looking at the square root of 3 over 4 times the square of the side length. And then for the arbitrary triangle, again, it's a tuple with this time of three values, three side lengths. And then we run our Heron's formula function with those three side lengths. And then the square will have multiply the side length together, the square of the side length, and then the rectangle will just be height times width. So, with that, I can use this discriminative union to write some pretty self-explanatory code, and it seems like it's very readable. So, because I've defined, the discriminative union, I can use constructors for each of the different possible shapes and pass in the appropriate number of parameters for that particular shape needs. So the square takes the one parameter, and in each case I can call my area function. So you're really achieving the same kind of functionality that you would have gotten if you had a base class with let's say a shape was an abstract base class with a pure virtual function or, an abstract function area that was overridden by all these different derived classes that then provide their specific implementation. Except that instead of writing, a number of functions equal to the number of possible shapes that you wanted to have areas for, plus an abstract function in the base class, we really just have one function, and the formula is represented quite simply, just on one line. So there's sort of less overhead there. We can continue with this by looking at the triangle, which takes our three parameters, and computing the area of that, and it all works just fine. We can certainly run this code to make sure that it does. Make sure I include everything. and hit Alt Enter to run it. And we can just verify an area of the square with side length of 10 is 100. The area of a triangle with sides 30, 40, and 50 is 600. The area of a rectangle with height 5 and width 10 is 50.
So. Okay, great. Thanks, Gordon.
Thank you.